This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Joe Sacco is a radical cartoonist and journalist who has spent years writing and drawing the stories of contemporary conflicts in the Middle East and the former Yugoslavia. His two-volume graphic novel, Palestine, won an American Book Award in 1996. A subsequent book, Safe Area Garaji, describes the experiences of Muslims in Bosnia in the mid-1990s. Joe Sacco's most recent book is a depiction of the first day of the Battle of the Somme, July 1st, 1916. The book opens out accordion style into a panorama that unfolds over 8 meters. Joe Sacco was in Vancouver on November 6th to speak with Charlie Smith of the Georges Strait and Chris Brayshaw of Pulp Fiction Books. Charlie Smith began the conversation by asking about the new book, The Great War. He wanted to know why Joe Sacco had moved from cartooning about contemporary events to take a look at the First World War.
It wasn't really my idea. What happened is a guy named Matt Weiland, who I was living with in the 1990s in New York City, when we were living together, it was some drunken night, we were playing darts, and he was interested in the First World War, and he knew I was, and he said, wouldn't it be great if you drew a panorama of the Western Front during the war? And his model for it was something by a guy named Matteo Pericoli called Manhattan Unfurled, which is like an accordion fold-out of the skyline of Manhattan. It's an amazing book. But, you know, I sort of said, sure, that's a great idea. And then I got on with my life. And about 15 years later, he called up. Now he was an editor at W.W. Norton. And he said, remember that idea we talked about, you drawing the First World War? And I said, yeah, what about it? And he said, do you want to do that? And my first reaction was no, because I had other plans. But I thought about it. And the truth is, I've spent a lot of time thinking about the First World War. I've been, I grew up in Australia, so another Commonwealth country, and there, Anzac Day, the day that the Australians, New Zealanders, some French and British troops also, landed at Gallipoli, really figures into the national consciousness. So I grew up with all the commemorations of that. And I used to read about it when I was a boy. And I was kind of fascinated in that way that boys are by things like gas masks and, you know, biplanes. And when I began to read about it, I mean, it was attractive because it was weird, but it was also repellent. Phrases like no man's land, which as a boy you take really literally. What does that really mean, that no man can enter that land? Over the years, I found myself reading more about it. And when I was in my late 20s, I actually visited the Somme battlefield and Flanders battlefields and just walked among the graves for about 4 or 5 days, just reading headstones. So it's sort of, it's been present in my life. And finally, I thought, okay, here's this offer to do this. Maybe I should redeem that boy with those weird interests and... It's got sort of a penance, I decided to draw it.
The panorama is not a super modern form. It's very different from the montage or collage effects that you use in the course of producing, a graphic novel. Can you talk a little bit about how you actually went about structuring the panorama and particularly what kind of research that might have involved? The First World War is distant to us in a way that, say, like, you know, present-day Egypt or Eastern Europe isn't. Just... you know, simple things like visual reference.
Well, what I did is there were a few things I did. you know, I looked at my books and I saw the photographs I had. And I knew that wasn't enough. So I went to London. I went to the Imperial War Museum and spent some time in their photo archive just going through and finding photographs of details. I mean, little things you wouldn't really see in most picture, even picture books of the First World War. And I collected that. I sat with a World War I historian named Julian Petkowski just to go over all those things I didn't understand about the mechanics of going over the top, for example. And, you know, there are no photographs really of battle itself from the First World War. I mean, most of the photographs are by official artists, official war photographers, and it was not practical, probably, to go over with a camera, which were heavy. But beyond that, you didn't want to... I mean, an official war photographer is going to be careful about what he's taking a picture of. So a lot of the imagery of that I got from reading books. Martin Middlebrook's First Day on the Somme, Lynn McDonald's book, Somme. There were many. And you read those first-person accounts. And, I mean, that's the power of prose. When you're reading prose, you get images in your head. So I had this idea, well, I'll just translate these images into... or these images in my head onto paper. So all that sort of thing. Plus, you know, you can go to YouTube and look up certain howitzers. This is really technical, because I didn't understand a lot of this stuff. It's like you can look at a picture of it, but you don't understand how it works. Like, how far does the barrel go back? And what do the, when it fires, and where do the artillerymen, what do they do? So there's old footage, and you can freeze the frame on YouTube, and, you know, you figure out what everyone's doing. So there was a lot of research, I got to say, yeah.
One characteristic both of the panorama and your work in general is this, I guess I call it like a sense of teeming aliveness, where it's often a very kind of deep focus, like the world seems to extend way far back, and characters who are like maybe peripheral to the main action that's being depicted are just as important. That seems to me a quality that lends itself to rereading your work. There's always like new details emerging from the largest panoramas, but it's also something I associate with a style of cartooning pioneered by, say, somebody like Harvey Kurtzman and Will Elder on Mad Magazine, where there's millions of little in-jokes and millions of complicated little things buried in the frame that are designed not to be picked up on a, like on a first reading, but only on a second or a third or a tenth. Do you think about kind of embedding those layers of meaning in the work as you work? And if so, was Elder and Kurtzman's work some sort of influence on you?
Well, it really was. I mean, not so much Kurtzman as Elder, just his drawing style. If you're not familiar with Will Elder, he was a... Before Mad Magazine, there was Mad Comics. And what was really... He did outrageously funny drawings. And there was a script where something was going on in the foreground, but usually it was sort of subverted by what was going on in the background, where there were all these little jokes. And the foreground almost didn't matter as much as the mayhem in the background. I mean, you know, even the main characters would be, their hats would be changing from panel to panel. All kinds of things were going on, and I was really influenced by that. And my first comics were funny, or I thought they were funny, and I was really influenced by Will Elder. So that you really picked up on something. But the idea of detail, that's where I sort of got it from, was from Elder. And that detail, you know, over the years translated in my work to journalistic detail. And the knowledge that whatever's going on in the foreground, you can use the background to get a lot of information across. And the thing about comics is, with repeated panels, you can, the background, even if it remains the same, it's sort of something will carry over, background information carries over. For example, if you're in a Palestinian refugee camp back in the 1990s, there was a lot of graffiti, and the Israeli soldiers would make the Palestinians paint over the graffiti, so there'd be obscured graffiti all over the walls. So if I'm having a conversation in one of the comics with someone, and we're walking down the street, in the background you're seeing that all the time. So it's one of those characteristics that just stays with the reader the whole time and really sinks in. And that's where, you know, I credit Elder, I think, to that sort of, for that sort of thing. And then just the busyness, yeah. I mean, with that World War I panorama, I also thought of medieval artwork. Also, it's a big influence. And I sort of gave myself the freedom to think in terms of how artists in the Middle Ages did, where perspective didn't matter as much. You know, things were compressed. An inch could mean a mile. I didn't draw the thing to scale. And it was liberating, and it just gave it this claustrophobic feeling that I think is probably more true to the reality.
What attracted you to going to the Balkans?
Sort of a compulsion. I was really upset by what was going on there. You know, maybe it sounds trite, but that whole phrase, never again, that had resonated with me. And it's not that things weren't going on around the world, but, you know, I was born in Europe, so that it was going on in Europe had an effect on me. And at some point, I thought, I just have to go and see this for myself. And once I make that decision in my head, I just have to go. I mean, I know that's where the wheels begin to sort of turn. And I know that if I don't do that, I would really regret it.
And why Garajda?
Well, Garajda was a place that, you know, I went to Sarajevo at first. And Sarajevo was a little frustrating. I mean, there were some interesting stories there. But by the time I got there, which was late 1995, toward the end of the war, people were really fed up with foreign correspondents. I mean, they were relatively kind to me because I was a cartoonist, and they sort of said, oh, he's a cartoonist, you're okay. But people had told their stories and were fed up with the foreign presence. Garajda, on the other hand, when I got to Bosnia, was still under siege. It was surrounded by the Bosnian Serbs, heavily shelled, a lot of deprivation. And while I was there, it opened up in the sense that UN convoys could get in. It didn't mean that people could get out. But I had managed to get a press card, so by virtue of this little blue card, I could get on a convoy and go. And at first I thought every journalist was going to Garajda because it had just opened up and they were staying for the afternoon. And I sort of didn't want to be part of that pack. So about 2 or 3 weeks later, I went just to have a look. And I just fell in love with the place. I mean, you'd be walking down the street, and this is a place that hadn't seen foreigners. People would be inviting you into their homes. And for the first time, they got sugar on the convoys, so they were making cakes and, you know, come in, try my cake. You know, and they were telling their stories. And it was just, it was kind of a beautiful moment in a way. And I was just captivated by it. And it was clear to me that this is a place that hasn't told its story yet. So I thought this is a good place to put down the anchor.
Tell me a little bit about the work process that gets from an individual narrating their story, individual, therefore deeply subjective to you, an outsider both historically and culturally. How do you take that story and change it in such a way that it opens up onto like broader narratives beyond like, you know, whatever the individual's experience is?
Well, often, you know, you listen to stories and like when I was in Garajda, for example, you talk to one, two, three people and you begin to get an idea of what happened in the town. And then you begin to fill the details in and you realize that certain people's stories can fill in for the larger story in a way. I met a guy named Eden, I mean, almost right away. And he had sort of been in Garajda at the central times. He'd been involved in the fighting. He had gone over the mountains like many had to reach a point where food was being distributed. They had to go through enemy lines in the snow in the winter, and a lot of people died on these trips. He had gone to collect food from parachute drops when NATO was dropping food onto the enclave. So through him, I could tell the bigger picture. But I was always interested in personalizing it because you can tell the story of Garajda without talking about individuals. But that's not how I want to hear a story. So I expect that most people want to hear a story through the eyes of those who lived it. And that's kind of how I approach it, is who can sort of fill in parts of a story. Sometimes he couldn't fill in the whole story. Then you meet someone else who can tell you another aspect of that story.
Now, are there points at which those various subjective stories become internally inconsistent or contradict one another? And at that point, I mean, a journalist would fact check a story. You know, you work as a journalist, but there is a subjective element in the work as well. Do you have to confront people on the veracity of the stories they're relating to you? If so, does that cause you conflict in the community?
Well, you have to make sure that the story is true by asking other people. And, you know, usually what I've found is people have generally the same story. I did a book called Footnotes in Gaza, where people told me the story of certain incidents that happened in 1956. In one case, this was during the Suez Crisis, Israel occupied Gaza for a few months, and they were trying to screen the Palestinian population for guerrillas. And so they had the men gather in a school by loudspeaker. They called on all military age, let's say 16 and over, to go to the school. And the men were beaten, some were shot, but most just spent the time in the school and then were screened. So I asked many older men, now in their late 60s, 70s, and 80s, what had happened on that day. And what you find is, yes, there are contradictions, but the overall arc of the story is correct. Almost all of them heard the loudspeakers. They all remember running to the school. A lot of them remember specific details that were, you know, shoes lying on the ground on the way to the school, because people lose their shoes when they're running, being beaten at the gate. And then it gets very mixed up when they're spending 10 hours being screened. That's when their memory gets fuzzy. I mean, I was with a group of graduate students today, and they were asking about memory and all this sort of thing. And what was interesting is, everyone remembers a very sharp thing, like being beaten over the head as they were entering the school, but not everyone can remember the details of 10 hours waiting to be screened, what happened first in what order. And I was confronted with all these contradictions about what happened when they were in the school, and I decided to basically throw that back at the reader. I've always tried to be transparent about getting a story and about the problems in getting a story. But the important part is the overall story arc is the same. Okay, they get it mixed up, what happened in the school. Some people don't remember the Jeep being there. Some people don't remember this guy being called to the front. But the general drift is the same. And contradictions, I think, are natural after 50 years. I mean, there's a problem with testimony after 50 years.
In recent years, we've seen a lot of criticism of Israel in the Western media. We're seeing more of it. But back when you were doing, you know, Palestine, a nation occupied, or Palestine in the Gaza Strip, there wasn't much of that in North American media. And I'm wondering what did you see there that maybe a lot of other foreign correspondents or media outlets didn't see?
Well, I guess you have to go back to the genesis of my interest in the region. And something you should know is I studied journalism. I got a degree in journalism. And I graduated from school relatively left of center, knowing a lot about what was going on in Central America. But basically, my impression of Palestinians was that they were terrorists. And I realized, my mind began to change, or let's say I began to question that in 1982 and 1981, when there were air attacks on Beirut by the Israelis, and then Israel invaded Lebanon, and there was the massacre at Sabra and Shatila in Beirut, where Christian allies of the Israelis went in and killed, hundreds to up to you know, a couple of thousand, the numbers aren't exactly clear, Palestinians. That's when I thought, well, what's going on here? I thought the Palestinians were the terrorists. And that began to make me just question it. It took a lot of time to self-educate myself. That was reading books and spending some time in Europe where people have a more nuanced approach. And at some point, I began to realize that journalism and the way I'd studied journalism, which was this American ideal of objective journalism, had really given me a skewed idea of what was going on. And what I began to realize is journalists can present you with the objective facts. There was a bus bombed and Israeli civilians were killed, an objective fact. Katusha rockets landed on an Israeli kibbutz, an objective fact. But if those are the only objective facts you're getting, it's going to give you a skewed idea. And I realized the only time I ever heard the word Palestinian was when terrorist was also used. And so that made me wonder, what wasn't I learning? What was the backstory? What else is going on? It doesn't mean those objective facts aren't true, but objective facts without a context, without the whole story, is going to give you an improper idea of what's going on. And my idea when I went I was unclear what I was going to do there. I came out of this tradition of first-person autobiographical comics, and my first idea was, okay, I want to see what's going on there. I'll do a series of comics about what I find, but ultimately it's about my adventures in the Middle East. But when I got there, my journalistic training sort of took over, and I found myself interviewing people, taking notes, looking to fill in the picture of what life was like in the occupation. And so then I realized what I'm really trying to do is just get these voices across, whether they were angry voices, intelligent voices, or not. Just let these people speak. And, you know, I want to find out what they have to say, and that's kind of how I approach the subject.
Now, at the time, your autobiographical comics published by Fantagraphics, which were really awesome, but which we were discussing in the green room as probably being toward the low end of profitability.
Thank you for saying that.
What was the critical reception of voices that at that point might not have been widely available to U.S. mainstream media consumers and underground and autobiographical comic book consumers in particular? Like, at some point you became critically acclaimed, quotation marks, but it sure didn't happen overnight.
No, the quotation marks took a long time to get there. when I started doing all this stuff, the graphic novel didn't exist as we think of it today. It was comics, what I still call comic books, what people now call the floppy, existed. And the book that became Palestine was a series of 9 comic books. And the beauty of it was no one was paying attention, and it was selling in such low numbers. It was really disheartening to get the sales figures. It was going down every issue. Now, part of this, you know, I have to say, has to do with the nature of how comics were sold at the time, only in comic book shops, which, as you know, mostly it was superheroes that were being sold. The sort of independent alternative comics was really the ghetto within a comic book shop, if it even existed in the comic book shop. So the numbers were so low that, you know, Fantagraphics, my publisher, should have probably canceled it. It was like under 2,000 when the series wrapped up, which is really low for, you know, North America. But the good thing about that was it was under the radar. And when you're under the radar, you just do what you want because no one's paying attention. And so you can establish your voice I didn't have some large contingent of politically minded people who were just yelling at me because they thought I was an anti-Semite or I'm against Israel or something like that. I could sort of find my voice without a lot of noise in my head. And I'm glad for that because I was younger then, and you never know how you're going to respond to that sort of thing. Now the criticism doesn't matter in that same way that it might have then.
I was super impressed with your collaboration with Chris Hedges. It reminded me very much of a very beautiful earlier book by the writer James Agee and the photographer Walker Evans, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. I'm curious about the genesis of your book. I'm curious as to how long you and Chris traveled together, how you divided up interview subjects between the two of you, in particular, how you decided what information was conveyed as prose and what information was conveyed as either illustrations to that prose or as full-on comics.
Well, Chris Hedges was a New York Times correspondent, and we met in Bosnia. Well, the story of how we met is kind of funny. I'll tell it briefly. There was a time when the Bosnian Serbs basically disallowed convoys getting into Garajda, and I desperately wanted to get back. And finally, the French were allowing me on one of their convoys. And, you know, you had to be at the site to get on the convoy at like 5:30 in the morning. And I realized that I was there, and the convoy was ready to go, but they were holding it up. And they were holding it up because the New York Times correspondent was supposed to come and was late. And I thought, boy, they wouldn't have held it up for the cartoonist. So I was a little miffed. But he got into the vehicle I was in, and we just hit it off, just talking about literature and all that sort of stuff. So we became really good friends. And then he left the New York Times. He had some disputes with the Times. And, you know, we kind of have the same worldview in a lot of ways. And we did some work in Gaza, and we found we worked pretty well together. Then he was on some book tour, and he was in Portland, and we were sitting down for a drink, getting ourselves worked up about the state of America. And I was like, okay, let's do a book about it. And that's just sort of how those things begin. They usually begin with a drink, like the World War I book did. So put a drink in front of me, and I'll probably come up with a book. But, you know, we traveled to four places in America. We made more than a couple of trips to some of them. We spent 10 days to a week in each place. Each trip was about 10 days to a week. He was going to do most of the writing, so he was sort of the lead with the questions, though I would interject questions. And there was no sort of ownership about, you know, I'm doing this and you do that. It wasn't like that. It was more like, oh, this story seems really good to tell graphically. Maybe you can do the story. And we without really planning it, we quickly realized I would tell a personal story of one of the people in each section. That sort of developed very naturally. But he's great to work with because, first of all, he's a really, really smart guy. He's fun to drive around with and just pick his brain. And, you know, it's just great watching a great reporter working. I mean, I learned something.
You've encountered a lot of despair over the years in the Middle East, in Bosnia, and then you encountered it across America. And I'm curious how you would compare the level of despair or desperation in America to what you've seen in these kind of war zones?
Well, I mean, every place is different, and it's hard to compare on some level, but parts of the United States are like the third world. And, I mean, if you're driving through West Virginia, through some of these towns that are famous in terms of Union history, the coal mining and the unions that developed and the great struggle for wages and good working conditions, safe working conditions. You're going through some of these towns and every other home is collapsed, just abandoned homes, collapsed with the weight of the snow in the winters. And Chris and I looked at each other and said, this is like Bosnia without the minarets. I mean, it felt like that. And if you're in a place like Camden, New Jersey, where there are so many abandoned homes. You know, a place that used to have shipyards, Campbell's Soup, RCA, and now, you know, one of the most crime-ridden places in the United States, incredible poverty level. It's very disheartening, and there's a lot of despair, and in some cases, a lot of resignation. And what sort of struck me the most is that people seem to self-medicate. I mean, you realize alcohol, painkillers, and drugs are what gets people through, or it's religion. I mean, I'm not one of those people who... I'm an atheist, but people who believe, it doesn't bother me if that is what you need and that's what gives you strength, because a lot of the people who are religious seem to have a certain strength and conviction. And it's very disheartening. I mean, living in Portland, Oregon, you're in a bubble. Living on the coasts, you're in a bubble. Probably living in Vancouver, you're in a bubble. And actually, there are spots within the city that are not in a bubble. I mean, once you're in the street... You see
like
people
a block
are in the
away
street.
From here. Mm-hmm.
What's that?
Like a block away from here.
Yeah, exactly. So I was shocked. I've spent, you know, most of my work has been overseas. And I've done work in India, and I've seen, you know, this sort of poverty, and not just poverty, but hunger, that, you know, you don't really find, you find malnutrition in America, but not that sort of hunger. But still, it's, frankly, it's shameful.
NATO isn't running sugar into Camden, New Jersey, or the mountains of West Virginia. How do you gain the trust of a community that's basically had, like, you know, the rest of the world's turned its back on it in order to start to achieve the level of, like, closeness to your subjects that you need in order that people open up and start talking to you?
You mean in general?
Yeah, before you were, I assume you just don't, like, you know, roll up in the car and, you know, bound out with a tape recorder and a notebook.
Actually, sometimes you do. I mean, you prepare, you read as much as you can, but you realize that reading brings you up to about 10% of what you need. But that 10% is crucial. You need to know, you need to have a certain base level. But, for example, when I first went to Palestine, I sort of knew the basically what was going on between the Israelis and the Palestinians. What I didn't understand what was going on between the Palestinians. I mean, I would read about that, but sort of skim over it. But when you get there, you realize, I have to learn about the Popular Front and, you know, the DLP or whatever it is, and the PLO. I knew the PLO, of course, and I knew about that organization, but the other faction, the factions within it. I had to begin to understand what they were about. So you learn a lot. Now, there, I sort of practiced what I called random journalism, where I literally would get into a shared taxi that was going to a place I'd never been before. And you wait for the taxi to fill up, and then it leaves Jerusalem to wherever it's going, you know, Nablus or Jenin or someplace. And I would get out in... the square, you know, where the taxi stops, and I could just basically trust that within minutes someone would come up to me and say, "What are you doing here?" And I would just rely on that, because I'd say, "I'm here to see how you're living." And at that time, it was very possible for someone just to say, and normally it did happen, "Come with me, I'll show you something. You want to see how we live? Let me take you somewhere." So I really relied, and if you read Palestine, it's very episodic for that reason. You know, things changed. By the time when I was reporting the book Footnotes in Gaza, the Second Intifada, people were a little less trusting. So I approached it very differently. And I had to, because I was going to spend time in places that I didn't know, southern Gaza Strip. And what I did is I, through someone who knew someone, I met a guy who was trusted in the community. He was known. And also his family was respected, because you have to sort of know how what's considered appropriate, who's considered appropriate, that sort of thing. and he could speak relatively good English. And he was my guide. He became my guide. And basically, if I was with him, everything was fine because he was trusted. He was completely trusted. So through him, you know, what happens is, you know, you go to Rafa, it's like the first question you ask is, okay, who should I see on the street that's actually in control? You don't really go to see the mayor. You might make a courtesy call, but it's like, who's really in charge? And then you just go, and it's a social visit. You don't really know who it is in this room that is kind of the guy. But people come and go. They meet you, and you just let them know, you know, I'm here to do some research about this. And then they leave you alone. In fact, they start visiting you and talking to you. And then after a while, they befriend you. So, I mean, there are different ways of doing it, but that's the way I did it the most recently.
Mm-hmm. Your work is handmade to my eyes, almost unbelievable extent, like the level of detail. And I think about the amount of time it must, like, physically, you know, sit using analog means. Do you, many other cartoonists use computers to do lettering, they use computers to do backgrounds, they use all kinds of like digital assistants. Are you strictly an analog guy? And if so, is that a ideological choice?
Well, it's one of, I enjoy the pleasure of drawing. I mean, don't underestimate the joy of opening up a tin of ink or something and dipping a pen into it and smelling the ink and scratching, feeling the scratching on the board. I mean, I know you can do, maybe the idea is the thing, and I know you can do things with computers that can get the same idea across that I'm getting across, but I don't really enjoy sitting in front of a computer screen. I do enjoy drawing. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't do it if I didn't enjoy drawing. I only got a scanner about 2 years ago because I began to worry about sending things in the mail. I was losing things here and there, and I was thinking, I can't send my originals around anymore. And I don't know how to use Photoshop. And actually, I would like to learn how to use Photoshop. So don't get me wrong. I think there are things you can do with a computer that are useful that are going to be done by a computer by someone else because you're not doing it. Mm-hmm. So I should learn those things. But ultimately, you know, I mean, that's just, I don't even the word analog seems weird to me because that implies digital or whatever, and drawing isn't analog to me. Analog sounds like it's the counterpart, it's like some sort of opposite of digital, but to me it's drawing.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, Joe, after all you've done, you still have your passion for what you're doing. What projects do you have underway right now, or what are you contemplating taking on?
I'm working on a semi-pornographic satire, which I'm really enjoying. Then there's some long-term projects. The main one is I'm doing a project about ancient Mesopotamia because I became interested in social inequality. I mean, you can see from my work, and hierarchy. I'm curious how it all got going. So what I've been doing long-term is interviewing archaeologists, what they understand about how first civilizations developed and how those things, inequality and hierarchy, developed. So that's a long-term project.
Can you talk a little more about the idea of the origin of inequality? One thing we were talking about prior to coming out was the idea that if you work away at like a number of projects, just because you're working on this and you're working on that, you're working on something else, that somehow after a while you can look back on what you've done and you can see correspondences emerge between like these separate works of art that you might have not known that, you know, you may see something in them that you didn't know that you were up to at the time. Is that the case with the study of inequality, that it's emerged out of these various prior projects?
Or? Yeah. I mean, the truth is I was trying to get out of conflict journalism. I just thought I was sort of fed up drawing certain things. And I thought, well, you know, I, I did a story about India, as I mentioned. I did a story about African migrants trying to get to Europe. And you realize, in a way, you can't really get away from conflict, because even when you're talking about poverty, that's a form of, there's conflict inherent in poverty, which has to do with social inequality. So you begin to ask yourself some questions, and sometimes, I mean, journalism is useful for pointing things out. It's not, it doesn't always go to the answers of why things develop the way they develop. I mean, it can touch on it in localized forms, but I've become more interested in the species, actually, in humanity in general, not like, you know, this nation doing this to that nation or that group of people doing this to this group of people. I'm interested in all of us. And that's why one thing sort of leads to another. And it's not like you're really putting it together. You're not connecting dots so much, but then things are an outgrowth. Working with Chris on social inequality in America, and you wonder, why do people take it? Do they push back? Those are the things I'm interested in. I mean, and the thing is, you know, sometimes I do try to get away from even the notion of conflict. I mean, even the genesis of the Mesopotamia book was being asked, you know, I was asked, you know, go to the Louvre and do something about anything in the Louvre. And I thought, well, what I normally skip over is the ancient Near Eastern stuff, because nothing deadens the pulse more than clay pots. And I thought it would be interesting to actually do a book about that whole thing. And so I went to Paris, and I went into the building and into the room, and the first thing you see is the stele of, it's called the stele of the vultures. And I didn't really know it, so I'm seeing it for the first time, and it shows a city leader in a chariot with a spear and an army marching. And this is from like 2300 BC. It's considered the first public monument ever produced, that it has a public function. It's like as far as like a government document, basically, because it has script and writing. And in one of the tiers, because it's like a cartoon strip. It has four tiers with words and images, and in one of them there is a heap of bodies. I mean, in fact, when you read the inscription, I sort of read it. It's called a tell. It's a mountain of bodies that this king is dreaming, and later he manifests in battle, because there's another mound then. And I'm thinking, you can't get away from it. I mean, I came to write about first civilization on some level, but there it is again. That's what it's all about. It's about people killing each other for whatever reasons. And I'm very curious about how things are structured that happens, that there's an army marching to the orders of a king. And there's ideological reasons, obviously, because over his shoulder is the god who is directing traffic. You know, so all these things make me really curious.
Now, Am Jo Hall is going to go into the audience and seek people with questions. And I see a question up here.
Can you raise your hand?
You said, what issues do you have identifying as an activist? Yeah, what issues do you have identifying as an activist?
Well, because, I mean, partly it's that sort of journalistic training where I'm trying to be honest about my work. I definitely have sympathies, and I don't consider myself from the school of the so-called objective journalism, which I question the notion of objectivity. I mean, I think we all come from a place, we all come in with prejudices, and you have to sort of recognize that. I mean, Edward R. Morrow said that. You just have to recognize that you have prejudices. I'm all for activism, and activists help me out in my work. I mean, sometimes they're the people who introduce you to people, but it's that thing where, okay, you're there because you think these a story should be told, but sometimes you find something that goes sort of against what you've heard, and you have to be a journalist. To me, is going to be honest about what they're seeing. If you see something that might shoot the activist in you in the foot, you still have to report it. That's the difference. That's why I said I want to show people warts and all.
Question on this side? Yep.
You mentioned that you many times go to these places and made kind of a research. So I'm a graduate student, and I noticed that in many places, the researcher, journalists have earned a bad reputation because kind of instrumentalized the people. So have you think that the people you interview or the people you research, they felt that way, like objects?
Well, I think in some cases they did. You, especially in Bosnia, in Sarajevo, as I mentioned, you came across people who would tell stories of journalists throwing candy at kids to get them to scramble for the candy so they could take pictures. And, of course, the famous stories of journalists who would wait at corners to capture images of people getting shot by snipers. So you're always sort of fighting that. And you try not to objectify the people. I mean, I'm talking for myself. I'm very aware of sort of the sins of journalists because I see them. But I also am aware of journalists who are there for the right reasons or what I consider the right reasons, who aren't objectifying, who really do care. And even saying that, you always come across people, even among Palestinians, who just feel like you're there to make money or you're there to get... It's going to do nothing to help them. And the truth is, when people would say that to me, I never really knew how to answer that question. The direct question, what are you going to do to help this situation, to say, well, I'm going to write the story about this and people are going to read it, in the end, it used to feel sort of hollow in my own ears. And I've never been able to sort of, I've never really lost that sort of uncomfortable feeling myself. I personally don't feel like I'm there to objectify, but I often wonder what good I'm doing, you know.
Now, a question up here on my left.
As an American expat hiding in Canada, I was struck by the gravity and the truth behind what was painted in Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And I'm wondering if you're currently living in America. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts or hopes for what is to come of that country, which seems to be sort of rapidly crumbling.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. I'm actually very troubled. I'm very troubled by the whole surveillance, all the surveillance revelations. I mean, I'm glad there have been the surveillance revelations, but I worry. You know, I have friends who are Democrats, who will trust the current administration because it is the current administration, and. You know, my argument is, well, they're putting something into place that could be used by another administration. You think of Dick Cheney and George Bush, and the same things that are being put in place now and have been put in place under Bush and Obama can be used later to really clamp down. I was really heartened by the Occupy movement. I was really glad to see there was a pushback. I think... there is that element too. I mean, I think people are unsettled. People know something's wrong. The whole banking situation, the bankers being bailed out. Like a lot of people, I don't understand a lot of the ins and outs of it, but you know deep down that there's something really up with that. And the inequality just keeps, it gets worse. So I'm troubled like you're troubled. I don't know where it's going to go. I'm very disappointed in the current administration, I'll say that.
And now let's go to the top.
Hi, Joe.
Hi.
I'm a journalist, and I have a lot of friends who are foreign correspondents. And one of the challenges I find that they often have is they get burned out really easily, it's just a personal toll that being a foreign correspondent in a conflict zone takes on a person. And I'm curious to know if that has any impact on you and if that might be part of the reason why you might be veering away from conflict reporting.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, the woman from Australia asked a question about refugees and all that. And there comes a point when it's actually difficult. Once it becomes really difficult to report the story because it's just plain hard on you, you realize your time is sort of up. And I wonder if I've crossed that point. Saying that, what is harder for me than reporting is drawing. Because when you're reporting, it's sort of a cold profession. Journalism is a very cold profession. You're trying to get someone's story, and you're trying to keep them on track. And doing all that makes you very focused in a way that you're, no matter what you're hearing, you could be hearing the worst, awful things, but you're trying to keep the person on track. So you get the story, and then you go to the next one, then you go to the next one. And I know that adds up. But what's actually harder for me is drawing that stuff, because then you really have to think about it. And there's something about journalism that allows you not necessarily not to think about it, but not to feel it, sort of. But when you're drawing, you kind of have to feel it. And I think if you or your friends experience that, I'm sure you're feeling it just in that moment too. So I don't know. I mean, I think I'm over that. I'm over that hump now where I sort of think I'm not sure if I can do what I used to do. I never thought I'd get to that point.
I'm wondering, like, being a journalist who presents it in a cartoon form, has that ever become advantageous or detrimental? Like, for example, David Simon, when he was doing The Wire, he interviewed a bunch of longshoremen, and at first they were like, I don't know if I want to tell them anything. But then he said, I'm making a fiction show. This is not a documentary. And then they kind of spilled everything. Has a similar story come that way, where it's like, oh, I'm a cartoonist, and people, like, didn't take it seriously? You know what I mean?
Right. Well, there was that doing the story about the Hague War Crimes Tribunal, there were a couple of people in positions of power who didn't take it seriously. And the truth is, when I first started out, and I was unsure of what I was doing, I didn't really know what to say to people. So when I was talking to Palestinians, I would say, I'm working on a journalistic project. It was my way of sort of being a little fuzzy on what I was doing, because I didn't really know what I was doing, frankly. And I thought they would laugh me out of the camp or whatever, you know. But I sort of lost that. Once I got a bit more sure of myself, years later when I was back in Gaza, I took the book Palestine with me. And when I was interviewing older people, I would always give them a copy. I would pass them the copy of the book and say, have a look at that. That's what I do. And the reaction was always positive. And the reason I think that is, if I'd given them a book in English and they didn't read English, just prose, it would have meant nothing to them. But the fact that there were pictures, I mean, all humans sort of can relate to images. They could open that up and they could see pictures I'd drawn years before about Jabalia refugee camp, and they could somehow recognize themselves in those drawings. So they got it right away. They were kind of, they understood what I was doing. Then when I was asking them very visual sorts of questions, those questions that a prose writer doesn't need to ask, but I need to because I'll have to be drawing a situation, they understood why. They understood why I was drawing a map and saying, where were you sitting and where was the Jeep and where was this? And, you know, that sort of stuff that it would be hard to explain you were doing unless you actually showed them what you were doing.
And you've been listening to comic journalist and graphic artist Joe Sacco in conversation with Charlie Smith of the Georgia Strait and Chris Brayshaw of Pulp Fiction Books. You also heard questions from members of the audience at SFU Edwards. The Evening with Joe Sacco was organized through the Van City Office of Community Engagement.